KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
X.com.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Educators say we have to keep our kids reading when they're on summer vacation. They cite studies that show kids lose a lot of what they learn during the school year if they don't keep their brains as well as their bodies active. We're not talking about having them do homework. Librarian Nancy Pearl knows reading can be fun. She'll have some suggestions for young readers. That's coming up later this hour. In the aftermath of the Boeing 777 crash on Saturday in San Francisco, Boeing officials are again talking about the safety record of their airplanes. Longtime Seattle area Boeing engineers and assembly line workers maintain that outsourcing so much of the work that used to be done here and the focus on the bottom line at Boeing has tarnished the company's once solid reputation. But while the Puget Sound region sees Boeing as our own company, more and more work has gone out of state. Puget Sound Business Journal reporter Steve Wilhelm covers Boeing and manufacturing for the paper. In the recent edition of the journal, he's got a long analysis of why the South will win when we look at Boeing. Welcome back to the station. It's nice to have you here.
Nice to be here.
Well, before we talk about why Boeing is going to go south, let's start with the weekend's accident. I have read numerous reports that talk about the stellar safety record of the 777.
Yeah, it's a great plane, and there's been no crashes attributed to any faults of the aircraft. And in this case, it did really well in terms of keeping people alive in a very difficult situation.
So the plane looks good. We don't have the final report from the NTSB officials yet, but it's looking like it was possibly an operator error.
Yeah, it does seem like it was coming in just at stall speed, and they just made a mistake is what it seems like right now. Yep.
It's interesting for Boeing, whether or not it's the company's fault, it seems that this accident, combined with the sort of ongoing problems with the fleet of 787s, raises the company's profile in a way perhaps it would rather not be raised.
Well, I don't know. You can spin that different ways. I mean, the 777 performed fabulously in this accident. You know, it kept people alive. So I don't know if it really points at Boeing in any way at all, except for, as you say, just raising the profile and there was an accident.
Well, let's talk about that. I introduced you by saying that we in the Puget Sound region think of Boeing as our own company. But in fact, Boeing assembly might be local, but the company is no longer a Seattle-based company.
That's true. Headquarters went to Chicago in 2001, and Boeing now has a very large facility in Charleston, which is growing. And as we pointed out in the story, they also have space activities in Alabama and stuff across the country. But the corporate center is Chicago, and it's becoming more and more of a global company.
How much of that diversification, geographic diversification, has happened since the headquarters moved to Chicago?
Well, it had to do with the merger of McDonnell Douglas, which builds fighters in St. Louis. That's part of why they did it in the first place. So I think really the next big step has been the Charleston plant since then.
What was attractive about Charleston to Boeing?
Well, it actually evolved out of all the problems they were having with the 787, and there were two suppliers, Alenia and forgot the other one, that were there, and they ended up buying those plants. They were in Charleston.
They were based in Charleston,
correct.
South Carolina.
And then they bought those plants, and then they decided to build a factory there after the strike in 2008, which may or may not have been, or to some degree was related arguably to that. But anyway, they talked about diversifying in various ways, and they built the plan after that.
How much lower are labor costs in South Carolina than in the Puget Sound region?
Well, we picked up some interesting statistics for this story. Engineers were, I'm trying to remember the numbers, 80-something percent less aerospace engineers.
80% less or 80% of what they're
80% paid? Of what they are here, yeah, and it's like 84, I think. So there's a significant difference, and housing prices are lower, and office rentals are lower. It's just a less expensive place.
This is not just South Carolina and Boeing. You actually covered the entire sort of southeastern United States in looking at this story.
Yeah, exactly. And we went out there in May of 2011 and did a series just before the plant opened and been tracking pretty closely what's going on out there. And we just thought readers should know the degree to which there's all sorts of aerospace and automotive activities, very sophisticated, all over the South.
Well, I think that one of the sources of pride for assembly line workers, Boeing assembly line workers in the Puget Sound region, has been both length of experience, because the plants have traditionally been located here, but also this sort of sense of superior expertise when compared to other parts of the country. And you found that that was not exactly the case.
Well, there's enormous expertise here and a great legacy of expertise, no doubt. But things change. And there's also growing expertise in the South, both in the automotive area, which interconnects with aerospace to a degree that I think people here don't really think of. I mean, there's a lot of aerospace suppliers in the Midwest do both automotive and aerospace and find synergies there. In Charleston, they're gaining great expertise in working with composites. That's where they wind the aft end of the fuselages and put the fuselages together. We make composite tails here at Frederickson plant. So it's not like there's no skills there, but they're advancing rapidly, and some arguably might be ahead of us in some ways there.
We don't traditionally think of the southern United States as an industrial center. We think of that as the North. So how did that transition to heavy manufacturing happen?
Yeah, and it's not really heavy manufacturing. It's more technically oriented manufacturing. And I had a learning curve myself. We went out there in May of 2011 and did a series about the Boeing plant. And, I'd really started to understand how things have changed there. There was an enormous textile industry there, which collapsed in the 70s and 80s as everything moved to Asia. And they turned to car plants and started attracting them. And that has all rippled now into aerospace. But they've been pushing really hard to have advanced manufacturing. And, you know, in fact, the second biggest BMW factory in the world, 4 million square feet, is in South Carolina.
So there's a base of expertise that's growing, but it's also a cost factor that makes it attractive to manufacturers, right?
That is true. Yep, that is true. And then there's a whole union question, which is related to costs. And South Carolina is just intensely anti-union. And it's technically a right-to-work state, which means groups can form unions, but they can't require any workers to be in them, which really undermines the strength of a union compared to the rules in this state.
At the recent Paris Air Show, company officials were talking about the new generation of 787, and although they didn't come out right out and say it, they hinted pretty strongly that assembly of that airplane could happen in South Carolina. One reason was that the plant, I guess, is a lot bigger than what we've got up in Everett. But it seems also that cost is a factor.
You're talking about the 787-10.
Yes.
And it does seem that it's too long to fit in the Dreamlifter, the fuselage, and perhaps it would fit better in the assembly line. I don't know. I assume cost would be a factor. I haven't got insight into that.
What does that mean if that assembly takes place solely in South Carolina? Psychically, what does that mean for the Boeing base here in the Puget Sound region?
Well, it's just another one of those nicks, you know, another one of those little pieces chopped off. If the largest 787 is not assembled here ever, that's a blow here. And it means that, you know, you arguably right now Boeing's diversifying its 787 production with the Dash 8 and probably the Dash 9 in both places. But the Dash 10, if that's not done here, then that's certainly a blow to this area.
You titled your article, "The South is Winning, Why the Puget Sound Will Keep Losing Boeing Jobs." And so the assumption behind this is that at some point, South Carolina may have half the work. There are other, I think the IT group is being relocated, or a portion of the IT group is being relocated. There's talk of engineers being relocated to Southern California, which I believe is closer to McDonnell Douglas headquarters. So we're talking about sort of an attrition to the base that has traditionally been here.
Yeah, I think attrition is a good word. And, you know, to be sure, Boeing's ramping up to record levels here right now. So there's a lot of work going on in this region. But over the long period, it's it seems that there is definitely a shift towards the South, and they are creating a competing engineering center in the South that will compete against this region for work. And the gentleman running that, what is his name? Mr. Mooney used to be the technical lead for the 787, so he's a heavyweight. So it could be a fraught competition.
We're talking with Steve Wilhelm of Puget Sound Business Journal. Now, Governor Inslee has talked a lot about infrastructure and things that are needed. He was using Boeing as sort of the carrot in trying to get his transportation package through the legislature, which did not happen.
Right.
But do you think that the governor has done enough or done enough concrete proposals?
Oh, I think he's doing... I mean, politically, realistically, I think he's doing probably everything he can. I mean, there's a piece in the article about whether or not Washington should be a right-to-work state. There's a Republican Senator, Michael Baumgartner, has proposed that, and Democratic leadership is intensely against it. Inslee said that's not going to happen. I have no idea if, you know, what will happen there, but that arguably might be a step that the state needs to take.
Can you imagine that happening in Washington State?
Hard to imagine right now, but things change. It has happened in Indiana and Michigan, and it's being fought over in Missouri. So we just don't know.
Have you had any feedback on this long piece from Boeing union leadership?
I haven't, actually, no.
I'd just be curious, because if you're talking about a choice between right to work or losing your jobs, which do you choose?
Right. And, you know, my job as a reporter is just to reflect both sides as accurately as I can. As you know, there was a big fight with SPIA about losing their pensions, and which they didn't want to do and finally caved under pressure from Boeing. And I think one of the things to watch will be when the current machinist contract ends in 2016, what kind of fight might come out of that or a strike. That's going to be interesting.
To say the least. Steve Wilhelm reports on Boeing and other manufacturing topics for the Puget Sound Business Journal. His recent in-depth piece on Boeing, "The South is Winning, Why the Puget Sound Will Keep Losing Boeing Jobs," is in the most recent edition of the newspaper. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much. Be well.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Ten 19. How do you keep kids interested in reading? Librarian Nancy Pearl has some suggestions, and she will share them with us a minute from now on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance Proton Therapy, a pro-cure center. At SCCA Proton Therapy, doctors treat prostate cancer and certain other cancers by precisely targeting tumors while minimizing effects on surrounding tissue. More at SCCAProtonTherapy.com.
61 degrees in Seattle, heading towards a high today of 79, and the forecast says it's going to wind up mostly sunny this afternoon. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:20.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Kids are supposed to keep their reading skills sharp over the summer vacation. It sounds like a great idea, but as a parent, how do you entice your kid to trade baseball games and days at the swimming pool for a good book? Here is the woman with the power to help you make that happen, librarian Nancy Pearl, with us once again, the all-knowing, all-powerful Nancy Pearl. And today we wanted to talk, because it is summer vacation, we wanted to talk about books and reading materials for younger readers. And by that, I mean it could be teenagers, middle schoolers, elementary schoolers, maybe even board books for your preschooler. And our phone number, 206-543-5869, 206-543-KUOW, or you can email us weekday at kuow.org. And I remember, Nancy, all those admonitions. I know the library, Seattle Public Library, has had, when my son was younger, a reading program where you got stickers,
right,
and you could win a book if you read enough books. I passed by some, I think it was University Bookstore. They've got a similar program. So people who are involved in the book industry are
right,
pushing reading, but is it really important? And are there things that are not just work?
Well, absolutely. And I think that that's one of the mistakes that we tend to make, sometimes as parents, sometimes as teachers, which is to see that books, to posit books in a child's life as work or as something that has to be done, like you have to eat your vegetables, mm-hmm, before you can get to the dessert or something like that. I mean, for me, introducing reading to kids is something that we should do by sharing our joy with the way we feel about books. Now, just because you're a reader and someone who absolutely loves reading and that's your big hobby, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to have reading children,
mm-hmm,
but it's a good basis from which to begin. And then I think because sometimes we present it to kids as work,
mm-hmm,
you must do this, I think that we lead them to books that aren't going to entice them necessarily. And I think especially when it's summer, you know, we talk a lot about summer reading. Steve and I, every year we have this discussion about, is there such a thing as summer reading? I think that in general, what we're talking about when we say summer reading for kids or adults is we're talking about books that are going to get you immediately hooked.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when it comes to kids who we want to keep reading, that's the most important thing.
What's flashing through my mind right now is a conversation I used to have with my mother, who was an English professor. And every summer I would say, oh, I'm bored, I have nothing to do. And she'd hand me Moby Dick.
I knew it was going to be Moby Dick.
And
right,
blah, you know, I'm
right,
sure there are great fans of Moby Dick. It's a classic piece of literature.
Right.
But that felt like school. It was never what I wanted,
right,
to be reading.
Right.
For whatever reason, that wasn't one of those stories that just kind of grabbed me.
And I feel that way about The Scarlet Letter. Here's where I think actually that wonderful English teachers, of which there are many,
mm-hmm,
can do a terrific job making those books relevant. And Nathaniel Philbrick, the wonderful nonfiction writer, did a book called Why Read Moby Dick. Now, much as I love Nathaniel Philbrick, I have to say I have not read that book, partly.
But you did read Moby Dick, because I'm sure you had to read it in school.
I did have to read it in school, and I will just confess it here. Even though I believe I passed the test on Moby Dick, I'm not sure I really read it.
Okay, so attitude shift.
Right.
This shouldn't be about passing your final English exam. Summer reading, but it doesn't mean that you should just be reading Betty and Veronica and Archie comics either.
Well, I think
fun.
Those are fun, and I read Betty and Veronica.
Me too.
And Archie comics, and I was always rooting for Betty for some reason. You know, it didn't hurt me. I read all the Nancy Drew books. I read all the Hardy Boys books, you know, and you go through, first of all, you go through phases where that's going to be fine. That's all you want. That's all you want to deal with. I mean, I don't know, just speaking from these days, for me, I don't know what's going on with me, but it's hard for me to find a book that's engaging, mm-hmm, enough to keep me going. So I keep looking for really well-written thrillers, for example, mm-hmm, or mysteries, because for whatever reason, I don't want to put that much time and energy into reading. And to expect and to present these books to kids and say, the result of your reading this book is you have to write a book report on it, or you have to give me, you know, you have to summarize it for me. I mean, that changes the whole nature of the reading experience. And that's something that we really want to avoid with kids. Or if we're going to do it, make it fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, post a video book review.
Oh,
you
that
know,
sounds great.
Make a book trailer. I mean, that's so easy to do these days, and kids could probably, I mean, I'm sure they could do it far easier than I could do it. But we just put reading in this terrible, oftentimes we put reading in this terrible place of chores.
Right. All right. So how if you were to think of sort of the quintessential fun book that, say I had a 13-year-old boy who really...
A boy?
A 13-year-old boy. Well, I have an 18-year-old boy.
I know, but he was a reader.
He's a... Well, not so much right now, but that's another issue.
Yeah.
Another issue altogether. Okay. What would... And I said, oh, name a book that this 13-year-old boy might like.
Okay. There's... First of all, another thing that we might want to think about, which a children's bookseller just said to me this morning, was... You know, having a series is really good because then if you get into the first one, you know there's a whole bunch of others. So these are all series that I'm going to say.
Okay.
The first one is John Flanagan's Ranger's Apprentice.
Okay.
Now, this friend of mine told me that her experience with Ranger's Apprentice was that she took the first one on a trip to the Olympic rainforest. She finished it and she could not wait to get back home to get the other ones. So they had to find a bookstore in Port Angeles. Luckily, there's a wonderful bookstore in Port Angeles.
And they found this
book? And they found the next three because...
Oh, so they had to buy them all.
They had to buy them all. So The Ranger's Apprentice, nonstop action, great, great, great fun. Anthony Horowitz. Anthony Horowitz's Alex Rider series. Now, Anthony Horowitz, in fact, has written several books for adults and wrote Foyle's War.
Really?
Yes.
The TV series.
Yes. So, you know, he's not an inconsequential person, but the series that begins with Stormbreaker featuring a young, the tagline is a young James Bond, but, this wonderful guy, this wonderful kid named Alex Rider, and Stormbreaker begins with this, I think, a classic line, when the doorbell rings at 3 a.m., you know it's not good news.
I mean,
you couldn't stop. It's so, that series goes on pretty much indefinitely. If you want a little more fantasy, pure fantasy, there's a wonderful series by a young writer named Jennifer Nielsen. The first book is called The False Prince. That's another book that I think that kids, boys and girls are readers for all of these, early teenagers, mm-hmm. Of both sexes. Will like all of these. False Prince is just one of those books where you just can't put it down because as an adult, you might see where it's all coming. I mean, I felt like I knew on page four what was going to happen, and I was right. But I don't think somebody a lot younger would get that. In fact, I've talked to kids, and they have.
And they're just thrilled.
And the sequel to that, which is called The Runaway King, is out, and the third one is coming out very soon. So...
Okay.
We could go on and.
Well, no,
I got more on my list,
and so do our listeners.
Oh, good.
Nancy Pearl is with us, and we're talking about books for younger readers. That could be very young, or it could be high school age. And Annie says late middle school, early high school age boys are hard to find good books for. But here's a few. I just read a great book about Benedict Arnold, a tween teenager book all about his life. It was called The Notorious Benedict Arnold: A True Story of Adventure, Heroism and Treason by Steve Sheinkin. The other was by Christopher Paul Curtis, The Watsons Go to Birmingham, 1963.
Oh, yeah. Christopher Paul Curtis is, first of all, he's one of the nicest guys ever.
Uh-huh.
And second of all, just a really, really good writer. And we're not saying that just because he's from Flint, Michigan either. And we're both Michiganders.
Yeah, no. Our phone number, 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Christy in Bellingham says, I just read Neil Gaiman's new book, The Ocean at the End of the World. I know it's being marketed as a book for adults. I'm going to give it to my 14-year-old daughter. There are some very scary parts. I certainly wouldn't read it to a 7-year-old or give it to a 10-year-old, but it's about an 8-year-old boy and seemingly an 11-year-old girl. And I think kids who aren't too sensitive or young could enjoy the numinous aspects that kind of blows your mind.
Yeah. I mean, Neil Gaiman's Newbery Award-winning book, The Graveyard Book was really scary.
Mm-hmm.
But kids, many kids like really scary. They like those shivery kinds of books. They don't have the associations, perhaps, that adults might put on those. So I think Gaiman's new book for a 14-year-old and older, I know she didn't ask for our advice or anything, but I mean, I think that's great. And a lot of the bookstores are also carrying that book in their kids or their teen sections, which I think is a good idea.
Nancy Pearl's with us. We'll go to the phones now. Hi, Jim in West Seattle. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Marcy. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
Good to talk to you both. I'm a single dad, and I have my son every other weekend and every Wednesday. And what we try to do is, I've never read them, so we both started reading the Harry Potter books. And what we do after each chapter is we draw the characters that we have discovered on each of the chapters. And so you're using a little bit of left brain, a little bit of right brain, and then after we conclude a book, we then watch the DVD. So we're now in the third book, and, you know, he's a decent reader, but, and I also let him make the decision about whether he wants to read the book with me. And it's been a wonderful experience for both of us. I really enjoyed reading the books, and he really enjoys it. And I guess the kicker was when he concluded his first grade, he has to write a notebook, and a lot of what his notebooks had in them were the characters that he had been drawing from Hogwarts and Dumbledore and all the characters that were associated with the Harry Potter books. So it was a great thing to witness that.
Well, Jim, thanks for that call. And I should point out that Nancy Pearl was, I think, the first book reviewer in the Seattle area who read these books, because you read the British versions,
yes.
Right? I remember you coming on Weekday long ago.
Long ago.
And talking about
that's
them.
One of my proudest moments. That people still come up to me and say, the first time I heard about Harry Potter was from you on Weekday.
And it was true for me. I think you were talking to me at that
because
point.
Because I thought Alton should read.
And he did about 6 or 7 or 8 or 20 times.
Yes.
Now, if kids haven't read those books, those are still, at some sense, they were not only a benchmark in terms of kids' serial fantasy, but they launched 1,000 other books in that genre, right?
Absolutely. And I think J.K. Rowling will go down in children's book history for the contributions that she made. And I think one of the interesting things that she did in that series is that as her readers got older, her original readers who were 7, 8, 9, when the very first Harry Potter came out, as those readers grew older, Harry and Hermione and Ron and, you know,
everybody
grew older as well.
It wasn't that they grew, well, they did grow older, but they also, the books became more complicated.
They did. There was still a lot going on. I mean, the genius of the first two books is that there's action on every page. And we could recount the actions on every page, you know, locked in the Dursleys' closet and the owl coming and going to Hogwarts and the sorting ceremony, all of those things, every single page. As the books got, as she went on in the series, books 6 and 7, the last two books, are very dark. Mm. And they're dark. They're not only dark, but even though lots happens in them, it isn't the kind of, it's a lot of it is interior, you know.
Well, it's moral questions.
It's totally moral questions, which she's very gradually led the kids up to through her. I mean, I feel like I can't praise her books highly enough, because the more you think about them and the more you deal with kids reading them, the more you can get out of them.
Nancy Pearl's with us. Our phone number, 1-800-289-5869. We go now to Spokane. Hi, Erica. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Hello.
I had you on speaker there for a second because I'm watching my 9-month-old. I have a question. My 7-year-old is a gifted reader, and we're having trouble finding books that are appropriate in topic because she's reading at a 7th or 8th grade level, and we like right now we're reading with her The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and she started the first Harry Potter. But anything past that is difficult to, I don't want to expose her to things she's not quite ready for yet. So I can take suggestions off the air.
Okay, thanks for that call, Erica. Just go watch her baby. That is a conundrum because you might be able to read the words, but
right.
Conceptual.
This is something that comes up all the time. What I think is that kids are going to get out of a book just what they're ready to get out of a book. A 7 or 8 year old can read all of the Harry Potter books, and many have. And what they've gotten from books 6 and 7, or especially book 7, is very different than what a 15 year old would get from it. So in a sense, I'm less concerned about that than other people might be, because I believe so strongly in that safeguard that kids have. However, there are some wonderful books for 7 and 8 year olds that are greatly enjoyable and appropriate. And I would, first of all, not forget Beverly Cleary, Beezus and Ramona. Of course, the Ramona books are the most popular, but Ellen Tebbutt's is one that you don't see kids reading as much, which is just great fun. There's a series called the Penderwicks, and we talked about how J.K. Rowling, her characters aged as she went through. So some of those books could be in the teen section and some could be in the children's section. What the author of the Penderwicks did is make a very conscious decision that she wanted these to be for middle grade readers. Mm. And so she changed the point of view in each book to have the next youngest child in this family be the narrator. So you're always seeing the world from the eyes of a middle grade reader.
Even though the other ones are getting older.
So, and the Penderwicks is a terrific, what we used to call family stories. So that's another one that I think a 7-year-old. Phyllis Naylor Reynolds Alice books. There's a bunch of them when Alice is a teenager, but the ones when she's in elementary school, which, you know, you have a great bookstore in Spokane, a great indie bookstore in Spokane, that would be totally, totally right for that age.
I envy your child, Erica, just starting on this world of literature. Nancy Pearl, librarian extraordinaire, author of the Book Less series, is with us. And we're talking about books for younger readers as we are sort of enmeshed in the summer vacation. We're going to continue our conversation in just a minute here on Weekday.
-62 degrees in Seattle. The forecast says morning clouds, check, and then afternoon sun with a high today of 79.
Support for KUOW comes from the Northwest Traverse Series, featuring 2 multi-sport relays for solo and teams to include running, paddling, mountain biking, and road biking. The Olympia Traverse on July 27th and the Peace Health Bellingham Traverse on September 21st. Registration at northwesttraverse.com.
10:40. I'm Bernard Ouellette. A London-based privacy group is suing over American and British surveillance programs. We'll have more about that in the news at 11.
From KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman, and Nancy Pearl's here making her long-form monthly visit as opposed to her short little bonbon visit where she just gives us a couple of books. And we're talking about younger readers. And we just heard from Erica in Spokane, who had a 7-year-old, I believe, gifted reader, and talking about content. And Nancy reminded me of the name of a series that I loved because I could only remember the first name of the author. It's a 5-book series set in Cornwall called The Dark is Rising.
Yes, by Susan Cooper.
Susan Cooper. And these are fun.
And it begins, the very first book is called Oversea Under Stone, which has always been my favorite of them. But it was one of the later books that was a Newbery Honor book. Mm-hmm. I don't believe it won. So those are great. Those would be great, I think, for J.K. Rowling fans, because I think those are those are great to read aloud,
yes,
to share with a child. And there's something so special about reading a book with a child and sort of observing their reactions and listening to their questions. And two other books for that 7-year-old or 8 or 9-year-old. One is Grace Lynn, L-I-N, When the Mountains Meet the Moon. Just a favorite. I haven't met a child who hasn't loved that. And the other ones are the Maud Hart Lovelace, Betsy Tacy books.
Oh, yeah, I like those.
And Betsy Tacy, again, there's a high school series, and there's one where Betsy does goes to Europe, and then there's one where she gets married. But the elementary school ones, Betsy Tacy, and then Betsy Tacy and Tib, and then Betsy Tacy go over the big hill. I was lucky enough to be in Mankato, Minnesota, where the books are set, and I got to have lunch as a special treat in Tacy's house, and you could look across.
Wait, Tacy actually has a house?
They're based on real people.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yes, and so I got to look across the street at Betsy's house when they used to live across from each other, and they took me on a tour and showed me all where their friends lived. I mean, it was the most exciting thing. And the Betsy Tacy books, all back in print, including the high school ones.
Well, yeah, I hadn't heard of those since I was in elementary school. Our phone number, 206-543-5869, or email us weekday at kuow.org. Kathy writes, our son, who is 13, never sits down to read. He has a hard time finding a book he likes. He will start one, then not finish. And truly, he doesn't like to read, except he still loves his kids' National Geographic and other magazines. He likes pictures and short stories. Can you suggest any non-series books, suspense, action, thriller?
Yes, I would say, and this is like a perennial, one of my perennial, I think, suggestions, and that's Feed by M.T. Anderson, which begins with a line, "We went to the moon to have fun, but the moon turned out to really suck." So there's that. And M.T. Anderson, his other book that I would recommend also, again, these are standalones, is Thirsty.
Wow, they all have,
yes,
those kind of one
they do.
Word titles.
They do. And Thirsty, I think you can guess what it's about if your mind is inclining in that way. Other one-off books are the books by Robert Heinlein that he wrote for kids, which I would still maintain are his very best books. So there's Space Cadet, there's Red Planet, there's Between Planets. Oh my gosh, Red Planet is just thinking about it makes me smile because it's so good.
Well, I hope you pick one out of those and your son enjoys it this summer. Our phone lines are full, so we'll take some calls now. Robert's been holding in Bellingham. Thanks for your patience, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a suggestion for a series book that I've been enjoying. First, I just wanted to second the person who like Steve Shane's book. He's got that new one, Bomb, that's also very good. So I've been reading, enjoying Cat Falls Riptide, which is the second book in her Dark Life series. And she imagines this future where the coasts have been inundated by climate change and a lot of people are starting to farm the ocean. And there's a strong boy and girl character, I think more like middle grades. And the first book is almost kind of like True Grit in a way. There's this girl from the mainland searching for her lost brother undersea. Ooh. It turns out he's been taken in by a gang of thieves.
Well, that sounds exciting.
Yes, yes. And the scientific part of it, the things that she imagines, the inflatable homes and the farming and the aquaculture in the deep oceans. Right now I'm in the middle and they're hiding inside the mid-ocean trash swirl. They're putting some of their crops there so they won't get stolen.
Wow. Well, thank you. The book is called Riptide, and the author is Cat Falls. Thanks, Robert, from Bellingham for that. Nancy, you haven't read that.
No, I haven't, but it reminded me for no good reason. I mean, for no reason that I can suss out in my head of a book that, another book that I stayed up almost all night finishing for teens. young teens as well, called The Fifth Wave by Rick Yancey, Yancey. Oh, my gosh. Go put this on hold at the library or, you know, go to the bookstore. It's worth getting. I mean, you know, have your child read it, pass it on to other kids. It is so exciting.
Amy writes, I read these books as a teen and loved them, and I still love them. One was the Tripod series by Samuel
John Christopher. Yeah.
The other was Seahorse in the Sky by Edmund Cooper.
Now, let me just say great, exciting news, which is that the Tripod series is being reprinted. So that will be available. And that was indeed a terrific series. John Christopher was a great writer. And to have them back in print is going to be really exciting.
Well, it's nice to hear that some of these older books are coming back in print because for a long time, we were sort of hyped up for the new
right.
and all the old was gone. Annie, emails the Theodosia Throckmorton series by R.L. Lefevers.
No, I have not read those.
Okay.
So, but...
All right. Well, this is for advanced reader that needs an age group subject but a higher reading level.
Oh, good.
So there you go. We're going to go now to Erica in the Green Lake neighborhood of Seattle. Hi, Erica.
Hi. I'm calling because I have two children, one of whom is a runaway reader. He does great with reading, and he is 12. But my 9-and-a-half-year-old is kind of a reluctant reader. And he enjoys things like Diary of a Wimpy Kid and the Big Nate series. But when it comes to anything that has long chapters, it really kind of puts him off. And we've been guilty of doing what you were saying, which was making it seem like work. We've said he has to do 40 minutes of reading a day in order to earn his computer time. And so we want to find a way to make it more fun for him.
So, you know, what I might aim for are funny books. And here's some suggestions. Because like Diary of Wimpy Kid is a funny book. I mean, you know, it's hard for that age boy, especially not to laugh at that or laugh with it. Okay, The Great Brain series by John D. Fitzgerald. I think that's what it, John.
Great.
Okay, so The Great Brain, two brothers growing up in Mormon, Utah. They're Catholic in this very Mormon community, and they're and the older brother Tom is always making his younger brother get in trouble, basically. So, okay. So that is an absolutely wonderful book. There's a book called Harris and Me by Gary Paulson, who's better known for his sort of survival stories like Hatchet, but he did a very, very funny a novel about two boys spending the summer on a farm and all the things that they get in trouble doing. And a children's librarian told me the story that when she used to book talk this book, because it's a little older now, when she used to book talk this book, she would always tell about the time that one of the boys decided that he was going to pee on an electric wire. So it's just funny, you know, the kind of book that you would probably, both of them, actually, The Great Brain and Harris and Me, are the kind of book that you would enjoy probably reading together.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's a nice way of getting those 40 minutes in.
Yeah, I'm fine with the reading together. We just want to make sure that he does something besides stare at a computer screen.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more.
Well, good luck with those, Erica. Hope they work out for you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call. We're talking with Nancy Pearl for the rest of the hour here on Weekday. Many, many emails. Nora has a question. What about a 17-year-old girl? Not fantasy or futuristic, something fun, and that's also good writing. She loves friends and socializing and the challenges of relationships.
So a couple of books. One is Keeping the Castle, I always get that title wrong, Keeping the Castle by Patrice Kindl, K-I-N-D-L, which is a Jane Austen-ish book for teens. And just funny and clever, and a young woman who is living with her two wicked stepsisters and her sort of incompetent mama, and this family with two eligible sons, or one son and one cousin, moves in next door, in the castle next door. So it's not exactly like, you know, you're living
next door.
Next door. And how she deals with that. So there's that one. Unfortunately, wait, I have the best one. It's by Michelle Cooper. It's a trilogy. The first one is called A Brief History of Mont Marais, which is not fantasy. It's set during World War II on an island that is somewhere in between France, Spain, and England, but it's its own country. And this is about the family that lives there, their history, what happens when the Germans invade. Oh, it's so good. Codename Verity by Elizabeth Wein, W-E-I-N, another one that is so hard to put down, because it opens with a young girl who has been caught by the Nazis when she has parachuted into occupied France.
Oh, my gosh.
And she is being forced to confess and tell them everything she knows about this planned invasion of Europe by the British. Oh, my gosh. That's the kind of book where you read the whole thing, and then you get to the end, and then you want to go back to the beginning because you want to see how the author did it so well. So, and those are all teen vouched for, all of those books.
Yeah, no, with the seal of a teen. Okay, yeah. We go to Nika in Seattle. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah, I wanted to recommend the Swallows and Amazons series by Arthur Ransom.
The Swallows and Amazon series, such wonderful family stories about very, very, very independent kids. And when you think about how sheltered most kids are, and you think about what that group of kids did in England, were allowed to do in England, then it's amazing. And there's a wonderful line that I always get lost, that I always forget, which is, and maybe somebody could look that up, if not Duffers, you know, they want to go on this sailing trip, this group of kids. And there's this terrific line that the father, who is in the Navy, sends back, if not Duffers won't drown, if Duffers, I don't know, whatever. It's a great line.
It is. And there are a lot of these books.
Yes.
I at least a half dozen,
yes.
If I recall.
Yeah.
Thanks for that suggestion, Nika. Bobby Ann emailed, she wanted to know the author of Riptide that was suggested. That's Cat Falls, F-A-L-L-S. Let's see, we're going to go to Paul's Bow. Kim's with us now. Hi, Kim.
Hi. I have a couple of recommendations. Audiobooks are some of the favorite things that we do for reading, listening in summer. We Free Men by Terry Pratchett, that series, it's a great series, written very well, and the reader is awesome.
Yes.
My kids say he's better than Jim Dale.
who reads the Harry Potter books.
Oh, yes, Harry Potter, sorry. And then the other one, the series that my kids really liked was called, or is, The Strictest School in the World, being the tale of a clever girl, a rubber boy, and a collection of flying machines, mostly broken, the mad misadventures of Emmeline and Rubber Bones.
And who wrote that?
That was Howard Whitehouse.
Huh. Well, and the title alone is great.
It is so funny. There are pterodactyls and, a horrible school in England somewhere, but fun. Anyway, so audiobooks. I had to put a plug in for audiobooks for road trips or whatever, and
they are great. You're right.
And libraries are carrying so many audiobooks, are buying so many audiobooks for kids and adults just for that reason. Two other really funny books. one by Sanderson called Alcatraz versus the Evil Librarians, which is really, really wonderful. And that would be for like 9 and 10, 11-year-olds, just great. Another funny one, really funny one, is Whales on Stilts, which is written by the guy who wrote Feed and Thirsty, but for younger grades. And Whales on Stilts is hysterically funny.
And Nancy has talked about that here before. Kim, thanks for your call. We're going to go now to Mill Creek, where Hattie's on the line. Hi.
Hi, this is Patty. And I have a 16, 17-year-old boy, reluctant reader, fully capable, but a little precocious, more interested in immediate things. There's one book that he devoured, and it was Ozzy Osbourne's autobiography of Ozzy Osbourne.
Well, that would be interesting, yes.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering if you have any suggestions for kind of precocious rock documentaries, autobiographies, or anything along those lines that might get him to read. This summer.
Yeah, that's a great. That's great.
A good reader, Patty?
Yes, he is a good reader, but he just finds it boring. There's so many much more interesting things to do, including driving now.
Uh-huh. You know, Charles Cross's biography of both Kurt Cobain and Jimi Hendrix are really great books. Charles Cross was the editor of The Rocket. And so these are rock biographies. These are stories of these two men who came out of our area and are legendary, and they're really good books.
Yeah, and Charles Cross is a really good writer too. I mean, he just really brings them to life in a way that other writers sometimes don't, sometimes miss with biographies.
Okay. Charles Cross. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call, Patty. And with that, we've run out of time as always, but Nora emailed, better drown that duffers, if not duffers, won't drown. And that's the Swallows and Amazons father's permission for the kids to go on their sailing adventure. If you give us a couple of hours, we'll have the titles and authors of the books that Nancy and our listeners mentioned on our website, kuow.org/weekday. Nancy Pearl, author of the Book List series of books, and there are more than I can name off right now, also the host of Book List on the Seattle Channel and a regular guest here on KUOW's Weekday. It's always great to have you here.
It's always great to be here.
Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette's our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Join us at 9 tomorrow. We'll be talking to Seattle's interim police chief, Jim Pugel. You want to tune in for that on 94.9 KUOW.
What first responders are saying about this weekend's deadly crash landing of a Boeing 777 in San Francisco. In the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. Now, I got a question for you. Does religion cause violence? We're going to talk about that later today with two experts on religion and violence. But we also want to know what you think. Give us a call as soon as you can, 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. Does religion cause violence? We're going to take that up this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from Fuller Theological Seminary Northwest, offering master's degrees in theology and divinity at its Seattle campus, multi-denominational with on-site and online class schedules to fit busy lives. Currently accepting applications. Information at fuller.edu/northwest.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.